This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Parents send their kids to college in hopes of giving them something valuable to get their adult lives off to a good start. Now, a degree is valuable, but just how good is that start?
Hi, my name is Olivia from Michigan. I don't think that my college degree was worth the cost. I'm over $60,000 in debt, both with private and federal loans, and I pay over $700 a month towards that balance. Most of that is going towards interest. I wasn't able to find a job in my field as most required 5 to 10 years of experience, which I just don't have. I still live in my in-laws' basement and feel really saddled and stuck with this debt.
Olivia, like many of our younger listeners, was less likely to say that her degree was worth the cost. Gone are the days when a generation of Americans built careers with the GI Bill, or when top-tier schools like the University of California were tuition-free. A degree is no longer a golden ticket to a sterling career. No wonder fewer students are vying for slots in elite schools or even bothering to get a degree at all. What is the best way to cope with the cost of college? How do you deal with debt like Olivia's? And what does it take for your education to be worth it? Whatever worth it means. Joining us from NPR in New York is Paul Tough, the author of The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Paul, welcome to 1A.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Joining us here in studio is Michelle Singletary. She writes the syndicated column The Color of Money for The Washington Post. Michelle, welcome back.
Thank you.
And in Richmond, Virginia, Tressie McMillan Cottom is an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's also the author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Tressie, glad to have you back.
Happy to be here.
Michelle Singletary, let me start with you. Can you just paint us a picture of what the problem looks like? I mean, how much student debt are we talking about in this country?
Well, the Federal Reserve, the last report from them, student loan debt has reached just about $1.5 trillion. Now, when you look at the average, you know, it says about $30,000. But when you talk to individuals sort of anecdotally, just like Olivia, they've got $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, both in federal and private loans. And what happens is that is an awful lot of money for families and students, or, you know, once they graduate, if they graduate, to handle from their income, especially starting out. And so people are just smothering under student loan debt.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Michelle, because we should bear in mind we're not just talking about people who pay for an education and complete it.
That's right. Many people go to college, take out the loans, and then don't finish for a number of reasons. Some of it family, some of it they run out of money. And for African Americans and minorities, it's more so the case that they will have the debt and no degree.
Paul, when listeners heard we were talking about this, we got a gigantic response. One particular message from Emily in Cincinnati kind of sums up the feelings of many of our younger listeners, our millennial listeners in particular. Here's what Emily said.
As of now, I have 3 degrees. The first two were both bachelor's degrees that I obtained in 5 years, and the majority of that came from government loans and private loans. I came from a generation, well, I guess I can easily say I'm a millennial, so we were told that you need to go to college in order to get a great paying job, and then once graduating from college and looking for those great paying jobs, we never found them. And so we were forced to live at home with our parents, and, you know, the rest is just textbook.
Yeah, Emily, thank you for sharing your story with us. Paul, what's your sense of why student debt is hitting this generation as hard as it is?
I think for a couple of reasons. One is that the message that we've been giving to young people that you do need a college degree in order to get a decent paying job is mostly true. And that doesn't mean that there are great paying jobs for people with college degrees, but it means there is very little opportunity for people who don't have, who after high school don't get any kind of credential. So there is a lot of pressure, I think, and potentially a lot of benefits to getting a degree. But at the same time that this has become true, the public has been pulling back funding from higher education. So in the last couple of decades, we've cut public funding for higher education by an average of 16% per student, which is crazy at a moment when actually all the signs from the economy is that our young people need more education. So we've put more of the risk, more of the burden onto young people at a moment when they genuinely do need more education.
You argue in your book, Paul, that higher education as a system, as you kind of mentioned, is deeply unfair on virtually every level, and that at every step of the way, there's a barrier to entry, not just for poorer students, but even for middle-class students. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it was striking in my reporting how much that was true. I mean, certainly tuition costs are part of it, but they're not the only part. In the institutions that are most highly selective, the most famous and prestigious institutions out there, they are almost entirely dominated by students from the top economic quintile, from the richest kids in the country. And low-income and middle-class students are much more likely to go to less selective institutions with lower graduation rates. And that unfairness, you're right, pervades all of higher education. It has to do with tuition costs. It has to do with test-taking. It has to do with sports and recruiting. There are all kinds of barriers for low-income and first-generation college students who want to get a good education.
Tressie, maybe to build on that, if you would help us understand the link between student debt and, of course, the rising cost of college, contribute to this higher education system that overall has become so inequitable. I know that's a big set of factors to unpack, but could you at least start us unpacking them?
Sure. I think there are different levels of inequality, as Paul elegantly points out. So there are the inequalities, and there are some ways to group those inequalities. There are the inequalities that prepare students differently for higher education, and that's all that stuff that we read about these days. That's wealth inequality, that's income inequality, that's inequalities in K-12 education. So these are inequalities not just of access, but of resources. And then there are the inequalities between different types of institutions. So there are the more highly selective institutions, as Paul points out. The student debt crisis and costs are just a very different conversation for those institutions, mainly because they have the power and the prestige to select the students that need the least amount of resources. So the students who have greater need end up going to institutions that have fewer resources to help them meet those needs. Then we see inequalities in outcomes of getting an education, whether one completes or not. And that's one of those inequalities, by the way. Some students are far less likely to complete any type of credential at any level than are other students. But even if you make it through that gauntlet of all the inequalities and you are one of the successful students who finds themselves on the other side of higher education with a credential, the labor market and society doesn't treat everybody's degree the same way for reasons that are not just about whether or not people are prepared, but about what we value as a culture and a society. So the inequalities are what we would call cumulative, and they stem not just from changes in the rising cost of higher education, which is certainly part of the equation, but perhaps is not as significant as we sometimes talk about it. It really is all of those other intersecting social inequalities that are increasingly asking something of higher education that may not be possible given how little the public tends to be concerned about helping to subsidize the cost of higher education.
Michelle, I want to make sure as we're going forward in this conversation, obviously we're talking a lot about debt as it relates to an education. Is debt a bad thing?
Well, now, Josh, you just set me up. You know how I feel about debt.
Because I know you, and we love you, Michelle Singletary. I mean, is debt an inherently bad thing?
I think it's a bad thing. Now, I say that recognizing that we do take it on to buy a home, to get an education, but it's bad. It changes you. It limits you. And so I try to encourage parents to not take on all this debt in students. Yes, you have to have a college education for most careers. Years, not all, or paths to get some, income as an adult. But the way we market college education now is a detriment to families. You got to go away. You got to stay on campus. A lot of that student loan debt, half of it, is room and board. And so we should be telling our kids, hey, listen, I'm sorry, I don't have enough to send you away or let you stay on campus, but let's look at the community college system. Let's go to school for community college for 2 years, then transfer to the four-year university, and then commute. And so we got to change the conversation. There's two parts of this conversation. There's policy and the practical way that families have to deal with this debt. But debt is bad. Debt is evil. You know how I feel about it.
Yes.
I say it all the time. If debt was a person, I would slap
him in the mouth.
Yes. That's exactly right. And that's how you have to do to try to not take on so much debt.
Well, we're going to take a few more hits at this problem as we continue with columnist Michelle Singletary, author Paul Tuff, and Professor Tressie McMillan Cottom, and we'll get to some of your questions and stories as well. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. The Grow with Google initiative supports small businesses by providing free digital skills workshops and one-on-one coaching in all 50 states, helping businesses get online, connect with new customers, and work more productively. Learn more at google.com/grow.
You probably know a lot about former Vice President Joe Biden, but what you might not know is how his faith was tested when his wife and daughter were killed in a car accident.
God, why, you know, I got really angry. I shouted out, why me? Why would he do this to me? How can there be a God to let this happen?
Biden tells that story and explains his run for the presidency in an exclusive interview with the NPR Politics podcast. Subscribe.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing America's student debt crisis and what that means, not just for higher education as a system, but for today's generation of college students. I think we should talk about what we mean when we ask whether college is worth it. Let me get to another listener voicemail, and then I'd love to get y'all's sense of how we define the worth, the value of an education. Here's what Brad left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Brad, and I'm from Denver. And I just dropped my daughter off for her first year of college about 10 days ago and have given a lot of thought about the value of a college education. And while it's certainly about learning and preparing for a career, I think the returns are far greater and broader than that. There's certainly growth intellectually and exploring intellectually, but there's also the ability to grow personally, to become more independent, to live on your own, to live around people with different backgrounds and different goals and different interests than you. So I don't think you can look at the value of a college education as purely financial. I think the returns are far greater than that.
Yeah, Brad, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Let's work our way around. Paul, let me start with you. What do we mean when we talk about the worth, the value of a college education? What makes a college education worth it?
Well, I think it's a complicated question, and part of the reason is exactly what that caller was saying, that what we're talking about is mostly young people, right, at the end of adolescence and the beginning of adulthood, going away from their families for the first time. This is whatever they're learning, whatever they're paying, it is a transformative experience. It's an opportunity to change and grow, and that's what it feels like, I think, to most college students. And so I think it's natural not to think of it in economic and financial terms. But I think what we're hearing from all of these listeners and callers is that you also need to think about money, and you need to make rational, sensible decisions about money. And when you look just, you know, at the economic data about the value of a college degree, there's a lot of value to it. So what economists call the college wage premium, the amount by which people with a college degree earn more than people without a college degree, it's very large right now, and it's as large as it has ever been in American history. So a college degree, you know, on the whole, is worth it. But I think Michelle is exactly right. We've got to use some sensible economic thinking and financial thinking in deciding where to go, whether to live at home, what kind of degree to pursue. There are some decisions, I would say, that involve debt that are not evil, that are not wrong. Sometimes borrowing a certain amount of money to get a college degree is a great investment. But there are other decisions, I think, where it is clearly a mistake.
Michelle, in terms of the value of an education, you know, I want you to speak specifically to the economics of it, because I wonder what our criteria are for determining value. You know, I went to the University of Miami, which is a private, nonprofit institution, spent a lot of money, got deep in bed with a young woman named Sally Mae, who basically recently just stopped calling me. You know, it was the worst hookup of my whole life, because she would just be like, can I speak to Josh, please? I'm going to show up on your job. So I finally kicked her to the curb. Right. But I have since paid off my college education. I graduated in 2002. I was not able to really get a handle on my college finances until I got this job. So basically, it took me 14 years to get over the financial piece. But I got hired right out of college. Like, I was able to get a job in college that took me immediately into my career. So, you know, I kind of see all the sides of it. Like, UM propelled me directly into a career in the one profession I wanted to do, but I had to drag these lead weights economically behind me for damn near as long as it took me to get out of grade school.
Right. And I bet you got that job not because of the university you went to, but I bet, knowing a little bit about you, that you were doing a lot of things in college, like internships and training and working for the radio station. Am I wrong about that?
I didn't do an internship, but that's just because I knocked on the door of the local station until they hired me.
Right.
I just kind of like fought to get in.
Right. So they didn't open that door. They didn't have a little peephole that said, what college did you go to? And then they opened the peephole and let you in.
I brought a drill. And just kind of made a hole for myself. Yeah.
So this is what I tell my children. I have three children, one who just finished her master's. None of them have debt, nor do we have debt. But my conversation with my children was this. Going to college is about getting a job. I am an African-American woman who came from the inner city of Baltimore City. We did not have the luxury to say, oh, baby, go to college so you can read Waiting for Godot. You need to go to college to get a job. That is the practical thing about it for most of Americans. Yes, I love what Brad said. You know, I learned a lot in college. But the fact of the matter is, my number one goal for myself and my children was to get a job. And it doesn't necessarily matter what university you go to, if you have internships, if you have chutzpah, which is what you had. Studies after studies that show that children who or students who are gifted in terms of self-promoting themselves and going out there and getting internships and stuff, those are the ones that succeed. And it does. I tell people this all the time. I work for the Washington Post, one of the greatest newspapers in the world. I grew up in inner city Baltimore, went to my state college, didn't have a great SAT scores, but I had a great internships. And that's what opened the doors for me. And the person sitting across from me went to Harvard, loved him to death, but we both got to the Post at the very same time.
We talked about the value of getting a job or the ability to get a job. Paul, I'd love to get your response to this voicemail from Thomas. Here's what Thomas put in our inbox.
This is Thomas calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. I have two college degrees, an associate's degree from a small junior college, and I have a baccalaureate degree from a private college in Mishawaka, Indiana. I am a registered nurse and have been one for 40 years. I changed jobs in 2009. I, at that time, was earning approximately $50,000 a year less than I'm earning now. So over the course of 10 years, my salary doubled, and it was because I have a baccalaureate degree.
Thomas, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Paul, a lot of businesses still use a lack of a degree as a way to either weed people out for jobs or as an excuse to pay people less. I understand it in certain professions, like, say, being a physician. You have to have a degree and be board certified to be a physician. But what about in other professions? You know, I mean, we're hiring here at 1A, and we've had a long conversation about whether you need to have a degree to be a journalist. How do you see that discussion about whether people actually need degrees to be successful professionals?
I think there are two sides to that question. I mean, one is sort of the philosophical side. What do people really learn in college, and is it necessary for them to do the kind of jobs that they want to do? And I'm actually sort of a higher education skeptic on that level. I dropped out of college twice and didn't end up getting a BA and have had a career in journalism. So I started a long time ago when I think it might have been easier to do that than it is today. But I'm definitely sympathetic to that idea. But at the same time, I think we need to be realistic about the fact that, you know, most programs like 1A, most jobs like the ones you're hiring for, absolutely require a college degree. And so arguing that they shouldn't doesn't help the young people who are applying for them. I mean, I think that what happens, like, I'm completely with Michelle on the idea that the reason you go to college is to get a job, to get the skills that will get you a job. The place where I'm not entirely in agreement with her is on whether reading Waiting for Godot can help you get a job. Because I think there are some careers and professions where direct training is useful. But in a knowledge economy, it really strikes me that so much of what is happening at universities, the way that young people are learning to analyze ideas, to read, to argue, to work with each other in teams. All of that stuff sometimes happens when you're studying math, sometimes happens when you're studying Waiting for Godot, and all of that really does boil down to job skills in a knowledge economy.
Tressie, let me get a comment about a for-profit college. CJ tweeted, "My husband attended a for-profit college that closed with over $90,000 in debt, $90,000. His school closed and he was given the option of erasing his student loan and not having a degree, or keeping his degree and keeping the debt. How is this the fulfillment of a promising future?" Tressie?
It isn't. So the most dangerous position, we talk about student loan debt. It is, it is a problem. It's a social problem, a political problem. It is more a problem for some students as opposed to other kinds of students. It is the biggest problem for those who have debt and no degree. And the students who are most likely to be in that position go to the least selective institutions, and there is a high concentration of those students in the for-profit college sector, which is one of the reasons why I say it is an example, an extreme example of the trend lines that are reshaping higher education and how we go to school and work and how we pay for it. And the extreme nature of the case is exemplified there in that story.
One listener who chose to remain anonymous shared on our Facebook page, "I have $200,000 of debt from law school and undergrad. I got a job that makes that number payable within 10 years, but I don't have the opportunity to do the kind of work that I want. It feels deeply wrong that my friends who had generational wealth have that freedom. They can buy homes, have children, work for nonprofits. I can't afford to use my degree to do good or make the life that I wanted." When we continue, I want to talk about ways to make a college education work. We brought up the idea of doing, say, 2 years at a community college, which in some states are just called a state college. Florida has renamed them, for example, and then going on to university. There's also the potential of making connections when you're in college, like I did at UM. What's the best way about it to save the most money? We'll get some of your thoughts and more of your stories in a minute. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make for safer journeys for everyone. All driver partners go through a multi-step safety screen before their first trip, including driving and criminal history checks. And Uber is introducing a brand new safety technology called RideCheck, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
An incident in Nashville that shocked the Latino community. A computer designed to control the entire Chilean economy. A Martian invasion in Ecuador. Radio Ambulante is back with a brand new season. NPR's Spanish language podcast will take you around Latin America to show you the fascinating, strange, and compelling stories of the region. Subscribe and listen every Tuesday.
This week marks 18 years since the 9/11 terror attacks. And we'd love your help with our conversation on Wednesday. Depending on who you are, the attacks are either an indelible memory or a lesson in a history book. There are generations of kids today who have no living memory of 9/11. If you are too young to remember the attacks when they happened, what do they mean to you, if anything? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Now, perhaps you're the parent or the teacher of such a young person. How have you tried to relate to them what 9/11 means? How well did that go? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. Or you can send us an audio file with our app, 1A Vox Pop. You'll find 1A Vox Pop, that's VOXPOP, in the App Store. And we'll share some of your stories Wednesday on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Paul Tough, Michelle Singletary, and Tressie McMillan-Cottom. Let's get to some more of your comments. And Paul, I'd like you to respond to this simple but difficult question from Lou, who tweeted, "Whose fault is it? Are the loans too easy to obtain? Is the interest rate too high? Do students and families not understand that the money is a debt that needs to be repaid? Is the cost of college too high? Paul, how would you answer Lou? Whose fault is it?
Well, I want to pick up on something that, Dr. Cottam said, which is that we need to think of this question in collective and social terms more than individual terms. Yes, individuals can make better decisions about college and about debt than they sometimes are, but the problem in the system already is that we, as Dr. Cottam shows in her book, Lower Ed, we have transferred so much of the risk and of the expense of higher education from the public, where it more rightly belongs, onto private individuals. And that especially causes strain for individuals without a lot of family resources. So that's where we need to think. We need to think about the public funding of higher education, what we're doing especially for young people who aren't particularly crazy about school when they get out of high school, but still need some kind of credential, some kind of education in order to get the skills they need to earn a living. That's where I think we need to put more of our attention.
Well, and Tressie, when it comes to loans, interest rates, students and families borrowing, studies have shown that it's different for for-profit borrowers. When it comes to those two-year colleges, for-profit borrowers borrow differently than for nonprofit schools, and they tend to default much more often. Isn't that right?
Yes, but for very similar reasons. It's just about the concentration of inequality at one end of the sector of higher education as opposed to the other. But people are experiencing this broadly in remarkably similar ways. And so to the caller's question about, like, who is to blame, which I think is a really honest impulse among us, you know, you see this big, complicated, what we might call a wicked problem, and we all want a really simple, straightforward answer. And the tough thing about this is that even if you have done everything right, if you have budgeted, if you have deferred savings for your children to go to college, if you are living at home, if you chose the quote-unquote right major, which don't get me started, there's a lot in that, but and if you do all of your internships and if you network, if you do all of those things, depending on how much you paid to do it, it still may not be enough. And there's no simple answer as to why. But the simplest way I can address it is this, that we have made it profitable for students to fail out of school. So student loan companies and private sector and venture capital makes money whether you succeed in college or not. And so the student loan industry has basically turned us transformed us from students into units of debt and profit. And when you do that, the entire incentive structure of higher education starts to fall apart. So yes, it's interest rates, and we should forgive, I think, student loan interest, and we should have reasonable repayment methods for the principal of student loan debt, but that still will only shift the needle so much, especially for the students who pay the most. And those are the students who go to low quality, high cost institutions like for-profit colleges and overborrow.
Yeah, Michelle, I'm glad that Professor Cottam brought up the best laid plans kind of going awry, because NPR did some reporting on one of these programs that's supposed to forgive the student loans of public servants after a 10-year period. But I could hear you roll your eyes at that. You just like, did you hear that sound? Y'all who listened, you hear that little, that was her looking up at the ceiling and burning a hole in the roof.
Oh my goodness.
Well, hold your horse, because let me just play a quick clip and then I will let you burn the room down. Because after those 10 years in this government program, 99% of the people in the program got rejected by the U.S. Department of Education for that loan forgiveness. Here's Matthew Austin. Matthew Austin's wife was a teacher rejected by the program. Then she applied to a program that was supposed to fix the rejection, and that program rejected her too.
What sort of Kafkaesque thing are we in here, where I apply for one thing, I'm told I'm denied for this, and if I'm denied for this, I should apply for another thing. And then when I get to the second thing, I'm told that I haven't been denied for the first thing. I mean, I really, I'm just cross-eyed reading these things.
Michelle, I think it's interesting that there are these people who do what they believe is the right thing for the right reasons. And even with all of that, just because of the complexity of paying for college, the best laid plans can still go very much awry.
Oh, my goodness. So with the public service loan forgiveness, what happens is that you have to pay 120 payments basically over 10 years on time. But it has to be a certain type of loan, has to be a direct loan from the government, and it has to be in an income-based repayment plan. So what happened is people were paying for 10 years and they weren't in the right loan nor the right payment plan. plan. And a lot of the reasons why they weren't is because they got bad advice from their loan servicer, or they just didn't know. They didn't read all the things about what you need to do to line it all up. Now, what happened was Congress, lots of people started complaining, and Congress says, let's fix this. So then that's when they came up with this new law that says, if you were denied, here's another program that you can apply to so that you can still get your loans forgiven if you paid it over all this time. But to qualify for that loan, you had to be rejected from the first loan. And so people didn't know that, so they applied for that. And that's where all that came up. But the point of that is, this whole conversation is, well, whose fault it is. This is why this is going on. We made this promise to people, and then we made it so complicated for them to figure out how to do it. Then they go along, and you know, human nature is, you sign up for something and you kind of sort of forget it. You don't check it. You don't double check it. And I'm a triple checker kind of person. So I would have been every month probably double checking, because that's just how I'm wired. But I understand how people fell through the cracks, and there was millions of dollars set aside for that. So the Department of Education should, I was going to say something because, you know, I'm from Baltimore. Their butt should be whooped. I cannot believe this. And the conversation is absolutely right. We need people to be skilled to get jobs. That is a public benefit. So the fact that we are not funding our state colleges and community colleges at a level that people can go is criminal. Employed folks pay taxes. Employed folks get jobs and buy homes, and they go and buy stuff at Home Depot. This is a public policy thing. Now, having said that, and you know, I operate on two, you know, ways. I write a column about this stuff that it's criminal, but on the other hand, I work with individuals. And until that public policy is in place, folks, you cannot take on this level of debt. You cannot let your children take on this level of debt. You have to manage their expectations about what they're going to do for college. So, and we got to talk about it on an individual level, because we have people with this $200,000, $70,000, $80,000 that is crippling to them.
So give us some good, I don't want to get us too much further ahead without talking specifically about scholarships, grants, and loans. Can you give us, Michelle, just some of your best general advice for dealing with these various forms of financial aid, scholarships, grants, loans, work study, et cetera?
So my what I tell parents is, you can hope that you're going to get a scholarship, but the fact of the matter is, less than 1% of students get enough money to go to college debt-free. So you need to plan from the time that baby cries in that nursery when they're born, and you're like, oh, they're so cute, baby. You need to be saving for their college education. If you can't save enough, then you have a conversation with your child. Babe, let's go to community college for 2 years. You know, you're going to stay at home and you're going to transfer. Now, if they're interested in a career where perhaps there's not a plan, a college nearby, then you talk about how you're going to get them to that college and lower the cost. I say take loans completely off the table for your family.
No loans.
No loans. And if you do that, then the conversation becomes different. Because if you say, I'm not going to take on the loans, then you're going to do what it takes to get that college education with the least amount of debt.
Tressie, before our time is up, I just want to give you a chance to chime in terms of for-profit schools, many of which do offer two-year career vocational programs. Knowing what you know about these schools, for people who say, no, I've looked at all the options, I still think this for-profit school is my best bet, what advice would you give them?
The single most important thing that anybody can do is to finish school. And the fact and the reality is, the social reality is that for some people, that's going to take money they do not have. And until we have a system that supports families and individuals to do that at a cost that does not burden them emotionally and financially with debt, we're going to have to talk more realistically about that.
Tressie McMillan-Cottom, an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. Her book is called Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Professor Cottom, thanks for talking to us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Paul Tough, his latest book is called The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. It comes out tomorrow. Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
And Michelle Singletary writes the syndicated column The Color of Money for The Washington Post. And remember, if debt is a person,
slap it.
Slap him in the mouth. Thank you, Michelle. Today's conversation is produced by Paige Osborne and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about our team online at theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.